From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. A new report says some 31 million Americans started but did not complete college over the past 20 years. Ohio State fires its band director because of hazing and sexual harassment. And yet another college, this time the University of Dayton, bungles a new logo launch. This is Casey Green, the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So welcome all. Ahead of our conversation, please note you can post your thoughts about these conversations on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. We begin our conversation this week with a new report on college completion, or more directly, the numbers of students who have not completed college over the last 20 years. This week, the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center released a new report revealing that over the past two decades, some 31 million Americans left college without completing a degree. Some numbers in the Clearinghouse report are particularly striking. Roughly a third, about 10 million men and women, started college but left after a single term, not to return to any institution. Some 17 million failed to get beyond 2 years of college, while 4 million got beyond 2 years. These numbers provide new insight about the distance to go for various groups of students who start but do not complete college. Of particular interest to policymakers are, or perhaps should be, the 10 million who don't make it past the first term of college and the 4 million who may just need, quote, a few credits more to complete their degrees. Joni Finney is joining us. She's the director of the Institute for Research on Higher Education at the University of Pennsylvania, and Scott Jasek is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Joni, let me turn to you. We see lots of data about completion, and we know that this has emerged in the last year or so as a national policy agenda as well as an institutional agenda. Is there anything new in the Institute report, or are these just new numbers? What should we attend to?
There are both new numbers and new insights. First of all, we've never really counted 96% of the population, which students in higher education, and the Clearinghouse is able to cover that in terms of the participation of institutions. They include both part-time students as well as full-time students, and they count students who cross state lines toward completion. So there's no data set that is comparable to what the Clearinghouse has. It's also new insights because there are very different patterns of the different groups you just described, Casey, that I assume we'll get into in a few minutes.
Well, actually, let's go into that now, Joni. What are some of the patterns that we should attend to?
Well, the first pattern of the potential completers, as the Clearinghouse calls them, the 4 million students have two or more years of college-level credit. So these students are students that they believe are the focus of the national foundations and other organizations to improve college completion rates in the short term. And they should be. They are a relatively young population. They look a lot like higher education now. There are slightly more women than men. And in terms of enrollments, about the same number enrolled at four-year institutions exclusively as the proportion enrolled in both two- and four-year institutions, or that have enrolled in both two- and four-year institutions. So these are students that higher education can and should reach out to immediately, you know, in terms of encouraging them to complete educational credentials.
Scott, those 4 million more students, those who've got two or more years of credit, are also the population targeted by the recently announced initiative of Starbucks with Arizona State University. We talked about that on a prior program. These are, in fact, students who are within reach of a degree, whether it's a few credits or a year. What makes that group would seem to be particularly attractive, not just for Starbucks to support their employees, but for any institution to reach out and grab?
Well, to any institution and to states. Many states have goals about increasing the proportion of their adult population with a degree. So they are very attractive, and they are, in fact, perhaps the low-hanging fruit of these efforts. But I also don't want to minimize the help some of these students will need to earn a bachelor's degree or an associate degree. It's not just a total number of credits, but number of credits, a major, gen ed requirements, and so forth. And for these students coming back into higher ed, some of them may be more than a semester or two away. They tend to be students, my guess is, who need good academic advising, which at many institutions, unfortunately, was cut during the recession. So this is a great group to reach out to from corporations or states or universities, but they left earlier. Something wasn't working, and so it's not just a matter of saying, hey, come back, but how are you going to get them to the finish line this time?
Well, also in the category of something's not working, Joni, is the big number of 10 million students who don't make it past a first term. At the campus level, those numbers can be small to significant. Some campuses retain most of their students. Others lose a large chunk after the first term or the first year. And at a policy level, when we look at whether it's the shortfall in aspirations to actual opportunities, whether we look at the amount of money of financial aid or student loans that help support those students in their first term and maybe a long-term debt going forward, those 10 million represent a very big population. What's the issue there?
Well, there are probably greater challenges in reaching the 10 million, but certainly a lot can be done. I'm still surprised at how many of the 10 million are under the age of 30, about 60%. So these are people who could come back into higher education and learn, certainly. But we probably have to have very different structures for these students to enter and to be successful. They probably have families, so it requires institutions to accommodate students at times that where teaching and learning doesn't usually occur. And we have to have programs that are workforce relevant. It has to be affordable, because at that point in their life, they're probably even more reluctant to amass significant amounts of debt in order to complete. So there are some real challenges there, but there are also institutions and institutional models that we can look to, and state models, as Scott has said, for that will support returning adults.
But Scott, the flip side of that coin for the 10 million is, as we've talked on past programs of This Week in Inside Higher Ed, many of those students are either not academically well prepared for college, have a misdirected set of aspirations in terms of the careers or what they would like to study in college as opposed to what's in their portfolio that they might be enabled to study for college. Again, this comes to questions about national policy that's been in place since the Higher Education Act of 1965, where the emphasis became not all who are able, but all who might benefit. That 10 million represents a significant number of people and a significant investment on the part of institutions and both the states and the feds to provide that opportunity, and an opportunity that's not been realized.
Well, the thing that the 10 million do have is, at some point in time, they made a decision that they could benefit from higher education. Let's remember, there are lots of people who never even take that first step. So I do think you have to figure out, well, why didn't it work? What were the policies and programs that didn't work for these individuals? Or how were these individuals perhaps not prepared? Some, higher education has been learning a lot in recent years about how to reach so-called at-risk students, how to help those who might not have had the best high school education or may have been out of formal schooling for a long time. In some cases, colleges may be better suited to serve these students now than they were in the past. At the same time, at-risk students, despite all we've learned, despite all the new technology that can help them, also need people to teach them, to show an interest in them, to advise them. So there's potential there, but it will also require an investment.
Joni, I want to return to a point you made earlier, and that is the Clearinghouse data cover 96% of the students enrolled in post-secondary institutions over the last 20 years. Higher education has pretty much spoken in one loud, unified voice against student record data that would provide national tracking. And yet the Clearinghouse data would seem to be a good case study about the value of this kind of data. Where do we go from this in light of the value of what you said were new data and new insights from the Clearinghouse report?
Well, the Clearinghouse has been, the research center of the Clearinghouse has been releasing a set of signature reports, and this is one, and I think it demonstrates to colleges and universities the value of this kind of data. It's different from individual student records in that we can't identify any single the Clearinghouse can. They can identify any single student and how he or she moves through. But they are releasing data in aggregate because the institutions are willing to hand this data over every single semester or every single term. And so it's probably the best way we have at moving forward on the data front without fighting, you know, a head-on battle with Congress and other people who don't want to have individual student record identifiers.
Let's go from data to insight and action.
Yeah.
If I'm a campus official in a community college, if I'm at a state public four-year institution, a baccalaureate or master, or I'm at any other type of campus across the United States, what do these data mean for me? What do I do if I'm the enrollment management officer, if I'm the admissions officer, student affairs, academic officer? Joni, what are sort of the three or four top-of-the-line messages that emerge from these data for institutional policy and practice?
Well, in terms of institutional policy, the first thing I would do after reading this report is get the data for my own institution. If I'm a member of the Clearinghouse, and most institutions are, I would look at how my students performed on these same set of indicators. You know, how many students started at my institution and completed nearly 2 years, or had some enrollment at my institutions but completed 2 years, or how many just did one term and have never been seen in higher education again. So I would try to identify the population that I have touched, and I would try to identify basically where they are and develop programs then for outreach. But one of the points I want to make that Scott pointed to is we, you know, other than, our first step here is understanding the groups of students we're talking about and their trajectories. What we don't know and what we need to find out is why they dropped out. Is it because they just didn't have good information about higher education and the type of institution that they should enroll in? Is it because they lacked preparation for post-secondary education work? Was it simply a motivation problem? Students just didn't want to do it. Or was it an affordability problem? We have all of those potential problems, and so we really have to reach out to these students and find out what the nature of the problem is so that we can address it.
All right, Scott, you've covered this for a long time as well. Top three strategies?
It's to get very specific. So of the students you're losing, are you losing them because they take remedial education and never move to college credit? Are you losing them because they never get to the point of really picking a major, but then when they pick a major, they move on? Are you primarily losing students from some socioeconomic groups and not others? All of those kinds of questions would then point to policies. Is our remedial program working? Is our onboarding to a major process working? I think the problems will differ from institution to institution, but they've got to take this and then get very specific and then ask the tough questions. Is it because students aren't prepared? Is it because there's a problem with a gateway course? Whatever. But it's taking this very important broad data and getting very specific at each institution.
Great. Joni Finney and Scott Jasek, thank you for the conversation about these 31 million students. Let's go on to talk about hazing at Ohio State and what that means in the broader context of campus life. Late in July, Ohio State University dismissed the director of its marching band following a formal finding of widespread and often highly sexualized hazing of new band members. The firing at Ohio State follows the hazing-related death in 2011 of a drum major at Florida A&M University, and what are the reports, perhaps once every academic year, of a hazing-related incident or even tragedy, often involving fraternities and alcohol, at a campus somewhere in the United States. The publicity about hazing and sexual harassment in the marching band at Ohio State and the dismissal of the band leader occur concurrently with the new Title IX-fueled initiative of the Obama administration to address sexual violence on campus. Senator Claire McCaskill's recent survey report on sexual violence and institutional response, also under the authority of Title IX, and the Ohio State report, which explicitly cited Title IX. Joining us for this conversation are Elizabeth Allen, Professor of Higher Education Leadership at the University of Maine and President of Stop Hazing, Kevin Kruger, President of NASPA, the Student Affairs Administrators in Higher Education, and of course Scott Jasek, co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Scott, let's go by for a little more background about what happened at Ohio State.
Sure. So, I mean, one key thing is that the Ohio State Band is a big deal on that campus, and it really is a very public symbol of the place. What the report found was widespread use of really denigrating sexist nicknames, grabbing, touching, not sexual assault per se, but widespread harassment. And I think what's important here is that we had a new band director, and some of the debate is whether or not he was trying to clean it up. Most reports suggest the conduct was longstanding and hardly new. And another key thing to remember is that this band is part of the university. It's a big infrastructure. It's hard to say that the university doesn't have some responsibility for what's going on there.
Elizabeth, you know, often for many on and off campus, hazing is most closely associated with Greek life and especially fraternities. And we had the incident with the band at FAMU. We've got this experience here at Ohio State. What's the broader context of hazing for undergraduates?
Well, hazing is more widespread than people traditionally thought. I agree with you that most often the predominant image that comes to mind when you ask someone about hazing is related to fraternities or professional sports teams, and maybe more recently, as you mentioned, because of the highly publicized FAMU tragedy with the marching band, people tend to think of it associated with marching bands as well. However, many don't realize that students report hazing in a broad range of groups, including even honor societies, academic clubs, and even intramural sports.
Kevin, often response or training about hazing falls under the authority of student affairs administrators on campus. No doubt NASPA has been working with your professionals about addressing hazing as they work with their populations. Can you tell us about some of the campus initiatives?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is not a new problem, and one that is really challenging. I think Elizabeth's point, the fact that it's unfortunately more widespread than people realize. I think this, like many issues, is a leadership issue. This ought to be a leadership issue from the president. Clearly, from any faculty or administrator who is responsible for a team or supervising athletics or Greek life, that kind of thing. So I think part of it is a clear statement from the institution and from leaders of the institution that there's zero tolerance for hazing at that campus. Beyond that, there's a whole set of training issues that we can talk about, but I think you've got to start really from the top and make sure that this is clear, that the institution and the responsible parties just won't tolerate this as behavior among their students.
And yet hazing seems in many ways part of campus life. The military academies have a long tradition about hazing during what's known as the Beast, when new cadets come in before they formally begin their classes. For many, and we see this in the situation at Ohio State, the folks who have experienced that are strongly supportive of that as part of the tie that binds in terms of bringing the organization and bringing the members together. Elizabeth, where's the boundary here?
Well, that's a great point. I think a large challenge related to hazing is that much of the behavior has been normalized, and we see that reflected in the language that students use and others use, alumni often use, to describe hazing as something other than abuse and humiliation and degradation. And And you'll hear them say in our research, when we ask about this, we'll often hear students describe hazing as, no, that wasn't hazing, that was just a tradition, or that was just an initiation, or no, we were just trying to promote group unity, and that was a bonding activity. So there are these euphemisms that get used, and the language reflects the culture, and I think that for many, there has been such a long-standing tradition that that hazing is not often recognized for what it is. Now, the other thing that we've found in our research is that students often see that what they're doing has a positive goal to it. So if they think, well, this is, you know, I'm helping to maintain a tradition or I'm helping to build group unity, then they don't see it as hazing because in their minds, hazing is something bad. Hazing is something that really hurts people. So we have a lot of challenges in terms of helping students and even the general public understand when that hazing can occur, even if it's meant to be a tradition, even if it's something that is intended to promote group unity. And there are other ways to accomplish those positive goals. There are alternatives, non-hazing alternatives that can be used to achieve unity and bonding and to have a strong tradition.
So, Kevin, Elizabeth has just given me the setup question to you, and that is, what are the alternatives that are presented to students in terms of that bonding experience?
Yeah, this is the key. I think this is the key point. This is the key point is how you change the practice of using alcohol, bodily harm, sexualizing an environment. How do you change those traditions and substitute them with new traditions and a new intake process, whether it be in Greek life or in bands or in an athletic team, that builds traditions but doesn't build them on some of these areas that are where there's all this forced coercion on activities that are illegal or inappropriate. And so you can do things to create spirit. You can create things that even are hard work on the part of the students to give them a sense that they've accomplished something without having to go through some of the challenges that you were outlined, for example, in the band incident. So there's a whole range of things that I think, and the best fraternities, for example, in the country, are really trying to implement that as an example, try to overcome this long-standing tradition of some of the things that have been really abusive and dangerous for students.
But Scott, tradition really seems to matter. I mean, for example, there's clear blowback at Ohio State. Alumni of the marching band have gone public with their opposition to the firing. As reported by Inside Higher Ed, quote, an alumni-driven petition demanding Ohio State restate Waters, that's the band director, has garnered more than 7,000 signatures. Concurrently, a Kickstarter campaign to provide money for the dismissed band director has raised $13,000 in just 4 days.
Yeah, I think tradition matters a lot, and it requires college leaders to do something they normally don't like to do, which is to tell alumni there were problems with your tradition. If you read about what went on at Ohio State for years, while no doubt many students loved the experience, it's hard to believe that all students did, and I suspect there are students who didn't participate in the marching band because of that reputation. It comes up in all the places that crack down on fraternities. But it's hard and potentially risky for a college president to say, hey, you fraternity alumni, even if you had a great time, what you did was wrong and dangerous and possibly illegal. And those are not conversations that presidents like to have with loyal, potentially generous alumni.
Scott, there's another dimension to this, and that's Title IX, which was mentioned explicitly on the first page of the report that Ohio State prepared regarding the harassment and hazing situation at the band. And we've seen Title IX also emerge in recent weeks in terms of the survey done by Senator Claire McCaskill regarding how campuses deal with sexual violence and sexual misconduct. We saw this in the initiative of the Obama administration in terms of addressing sexual violence. Is this a new dimension to Title IX that is emerging and that will be increasingly important as campuses go forward?
As with much of Title IX, I wouldn't say it's a new dimension to it, but it is getting enforced in ways that some would say it should have been a long time ago. If you read about what happened in the Ohio State band, it was a highly sexually oriented form of harassment, with women getting various nicknames and being told to do various things that were not random. They were very sexist names. And I think when you reach that level in the current environment, a university has to look and say, is this legal? If the new band members at Ohio State had all been told that they needed to work together to build a playground in a local park, and that they had to do it and they had to work really hard at it, my guess is there wouldn't be a Title IX issue.
Let me jump in here, because I think Scott, you're absolutely right on this. I think this is definitely what Title IX gets at. It was a hostile environment for women in that band, and maybe every woman didn't object to it, but it was enough women did, and this is exactly the kind of thing that creates a culture on campus that supports some of the problems we're having in sexual assault. So I think it's all kind of tied together. You can't just focus on one section of the campus. You really have to look at the whole culture. And if key places in your campus are sexualizing and creating hostile environments for women, it has to be addressed. And I think it's clearly exactly what Title IX is about.
Well, Elizabeth, does this now mean new kinds of the Title IX now becomes part of the training that for student affairs administrators in a new and expansive dimension?
Absolutely. I think that student affairs administrators are paying very close attention, and you know, using Title IX as it should be, as a tool and a vehicle to promote campus culture that is more equitable and that is more welcoming and less hostile for all, you know, women and men included. So I think that, you know, as was mentioned earlier, it's a policy that finally the enforcement is getting a little bit more teeth, and so we're going to be seeing and hearing more and more about it.
All right, so let's look forward. We are now, for some campuses, weeks away from orientation across the country. Tens of thousands of new students will be coming to campus. Others will be returning. What strategies work? What strategies seem to have some impact? Kevin, let me begin with you.
Okay, let me go a couple of things real quickly here. Anti-hazing seminars for students and parents as part of orientation, critical. Campus is doing anti-hazing pledges for freshmen. I think that's another place where we can look at success. We need to work with every first team meeting, every first group meeting needs some kind of overview on an ongoing basis. And it has to be, can't be just orientation. It has to be ongoing throughout the year. Every time a team gets ready to travel, the coach should do a talk about it, beginning of every team meeting. During the recruitment process, so it's a comprehensive educational process that's got to involve many folks, many messages, across the educational spectrum of the student's experience. And then harsh sanctions for those who are found responsible.
And Elizabeth, as we close, your organization, Stop Hazing Notes, reports that 44 out of 50 states have anti-hazing laws. Do the laws make a difference?
I do think the laws can make a difference. It's part of the larger conversation. I agree and with Kevin's points about there are many, many ways we can promote prevention and awareness and knowledge and understanding about hazing. Laws and policies are one piece of that larger picture. In and of themselves, they are insufficient, but we need to have them, and we need to have them be meaningful and enforced. As well, I mean, we need to look at all these different angles. We have to look at the institutional policies, and the policies within the individual groups, the visible leadership on campus, visible leadership from coaches and from advisors to the student organizations, and from the student leaders themselves. There's all those levels that we have to examine when we're looking at hazing prevention. So it really is something that requires a culture shift. And so I was pleased to see Ohio State using that language and the leadership talking in those terms, because that's what we need. We need to approach this as a shift in the culture, and that requires it requires some really strong leadership and some meaningful action.
Great. Elizabeth Allen from the University of Maine and Kevin Kruger from NASPA, thanks for joining us for the conversation today about hazing, not just at Ohio State, but in the larger context of campus life. Thank you. We close our conversation this week talking about bungled branding. This week, the University of Dayton joined the list of campuses that includes Drake University, Case Western Reserve University, the University of California, and Middlebury College to experience what some might call bungled branding attempts to launch a new institutional logo that quickly became controversial. At the University of Dayton, the new graphic to promote the Dayton Flyers, a red D plus three cascading blue wings on the left side of the D, was seen by many not as wings with a D, but simply as a V and a D for VD or venereal disease. Joining us for the conversation are Deborah Lucart, who is the Executive Director of University Communications at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa, and, of course, Scott Jasek, co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Well, Scott, you've mentioned that these stories about bungled branding, the logo stories and some others, are widely read and frequently forwarded. What's the attraction? Why are your readership so interested in these stories?
I think they speak to the way institutions identify themselves, and faculty members, students, alumni care deeply about how institutions are identified, and they're a little skeptical, I think, of marketing. Even if they may follow marketing and use marketing all the time, they want to think that higher ed might maybe be above that. So there's an element of enjoying a mess up. And then in the local communities, in some cases, because you have sports fans involved at some institutions, you have a very vocal, loud group that wants to express its opinions as well.
So, Deb Lucart, at Drake, you've been in the middle of this. The D-plus campaign that your campus launched shortly after your appointment at Drake was very controversial. Some thought it was just an act of genius. Others thought it was very controversial and would have a dire effect on your efforts to recruit students. Drawing on the Drake experience and having watched others, how does this happen and how do campuses go forward?
Well, I think a situation like this can happen for any number of reasons. It's quite situational. The experience we had at Drake might be simply boiled down to a very targeted and direct marketing outreach effort for prospective students. Ended up in the hands of unintended audiences and as a result took on a life that we didn't anticipate. So that's one way that things like this can happen. I think, though, for many institutions it comes down to how disciplined their methodology is in introducing something that is new and different to a college or university community. As Scott just said, brand in particular is something, or identity is something that is much beloved by so many of the constituencies connected to an institution, that these things have to be handled very carefully. It's very important that not only do you do diligence on the front end, but on the back end. And rolling out something new and different, particularly an identity, it's essential that you do so with all the right people and in all the right ways. And those are very broad statements, but professionals know what need to be done in these circumstances, and sometimes missteps are made and can result in the controversy that you've just described.
Scott, as I read the comments for some of these branding stories, these logo stories, lots of angst and anger about money. How much does money play into this, do you think? Why are they spending money on this? There's no reason to do that. That money would be much better spent on academic programs, particularly mine.
I think it does play a role because people hear about the costs and then they don't like the results and they feel the time is wasted. On the other hand, it's probably important to note that that's a little bit of a scapegoat there. Most colleges and universities depend on somebody, whether it's by marketing or other efforts, to generate interest and generate applications and students, or the college isn't going to function that well. So, but when things don't go well and they cost money, you can bet there'll be a lot of people very upset at any college.
And Deborah, let me come back to you with a question about tradition and unintended audiences. Both seem to be at play at Drake and at many of these other campuses. How do you address those and how do you anticipate those issues?
Casey, that's a very good point because at institutions of higher education, relationships are so important. Whether we're talking about those that we establish with prospective students, our alumni, current students, faculty, the relationships are essential. And when you encounter a situation that has gone awry, attending to those relationships is critical to success of a recovery plan. The relationships that you rely on most, you have to listen to those. You have to discern what about the response coming from those various constituencies is critical to your next steps. So assessing the reaction, determining what is the most essential from that reaction, to inform a plan moving forward. And, of course, metrics are really important, too. You know, what was the intended objective? How is that objective being addressed or compromised based on the response? And how do you adjust your plan based on the data that you have at hand, in addition to the more qualitative assessment of those relationships that a university or a college is so dependent on?
Great. Deborah Lucart, Executive Director of University Communications at Drake, thanks for joining us for this conversation about the branding initiatives of campuses and the challenges that they confront. So thank you for joining us this week, and our thanks to the individuals who aided and informed our conversations, Joni Finney at the University of Pennsylvania, Kevin Kruger, President of NASPA, Elizabeth Allen from the University of Maine, Deborah Lucart from Drake University, and of course Scott Jasek from Inside Higher Ed. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio stream or a podcast early afternoon on most Fridays. On the web, we are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. Please share your thoughts about this week with us on the comments section of the webpage. Thank you.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.